You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Is it because Elon said he was going to accept Dogecoin?
No, I'm talking to a bunch of people about it this morning that everyone got bearish. Like, no one was expecting a rally, which at that point I was like, maybe the path of least resistance was up. And one of my friends was like, yeah, I'm in this like 100% crypto investing Telegram group, and no one's talked about crypto investing for days.
Yeah,
there's been like a debate about religion.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the capitulation point was essentially everyone sort of universally agreed that there's no actual use case for Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these coins. And so, and on top of that, there's all these liquidations of, you know, hedge funds were liquidating and all this stuff. So everybody sold. There was no, anybody still holding is a believer now.
And there's probably just a flight to cash in general with the global market situation, not even
but crypto. I think that's been going on for 6 months now.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. The liquidations were, it's actually kind of astonishing. Like the crypto lenders, there used to be five big ones with multi-billion dollar balance sheets, and three of them got wiped out in the span of a week.
And what's his name? Sam Bankman-Fried said there's more coming, but maybe that already happened. He said that a few weeks ago.
Or it's priced in. But right. There is this funny thing that keeps happening where it's like some crypto lender I've never heard of. It's like, oh, they're suspending withdrawals because blah, blah, blah.
By the way, suspending withdrawals is not a big deal. They lent the money out. They can't just like get the money back. And
it's what we did.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's like a hedge fund can't return all the money every single day.
Yeah.
It's bad if your depositor is expected, if you know, instant liquidity. It shows you fucked up somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If that's the case, was there supposed to be instant liquidity?
Yeah.
Okay. Then, yeah.
For Celsius, there was, but I'm not sure for like crypto hedge funds.
No, not hedge funds. I mean, Three Arrows Capital, that one, like multiple people will go to jail for that. Because it's like, it's one thing if you have a project like Terra, which was just an economic design that wasn't going to work, but the people behind it genuinely believed that it would. And they didn't lie about anything. It's another thing, even Celsius, like, yes, they invested too much money in too many illiquid stuff. But Three Arrows Capital was just fraudulent on like five different levels.
Oh, I didn't know they were fraudulent. Like, in what ways were they fraudulent?
One, they said that they were only like a proprietary hedge fund that traded their own money. It's come out that they actually raised significant amounts of outside money. Mm. Two, they commingled funds. So they were managing money for some treasuries or something, protocol treasuries, and they used those assets as collateral to take out their own loans, which is kind of like, if you remember what MF Global did when John Corzine blew it up, that they couldn't meet a margin call, so they started dipping into these supposedly segregated customer accounts.
You know, by the way, which is fascinating, because John Corzine, okay, he was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. Like, you can't get a higher pedigree. Like, right. Like CEO of Goldman Sachs, people go on to be secretaries of treasury, Federal Reserve chairman, whatever. John Corzine, wasn't he governor for a while also?
I think he was governor and senator of New Jersey, wasn't he?
Yeah, so Corzine was head of Goldman Sachs, governor of New Jersey, senator from New Jersey, had some scandal. MF Global, just a total scam like anybody else.
Yeah.
And it was both, I believe at the time, one of the, if not the biggest futures brokerage firm. And I believe they had just gotten approved to become a primary dealer on treasury bonds, right? That's a privileged, difficult position to acquire.
Yeah.
But he had so much pedigree and so many connections. There was no way he would ask for anything and he
was
going to
get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this goes to the example, like we were talking about Uber earlier before the recording started. Like Uber's a scam and most people don't realize it. Just to summarize what we were talking about earlier, before they went public, the venture capitalists were paying for every single ride you took. They were subsidizing all the rides. That's how Uber could grow so fast and lose like $1 billion a year. And then the venture capitalists were like, okay, we can't fund this now. It's worth $70 billion in the latest round. We've all made our money. Let's just sell it to the idiots. So they went public and the public money is the dumb money essentially. And now the public can't subsidize Uber. Uber either has to charge more for rides, which they can't do, or pay drivers less, which they can't do, or go out of business, which is what will happen. Uber, Lyft, and there's other business models like this. So what isn't a scam? And Dan, you and I have had this conversation all the time. Like, what's not a scam?
That's a good question. I mean,
most cryptos are scams.
Yeah, but who's taking the other side of Uber though? There's clearly analysts out there and
okay, but we know the analyst business is a scam.
Yeah.
So like the analysts, they make a price target of $100 and if it moves down, they change their price target to 80 and if it goes down to 60, they say, "Oh, look, we're a genius." And then they call all the hedge fund clients and they say, "Trade through us because we're such smart analysts." Look, we said Uber was going to go below 80 when previously they said it was going to go up to 120. And it's all a scam. The analysts don't know anything.
And really the better question, I mean, you're really saying what VC-funded companies aren't scams, right? I mean, there's a lot of traditional companies that aren't, but there's so much money that, I mean, and Omen and I have talked about this also, and we have too, James, where not to bring up names, but Omid can speak to this, where he's had personal conversations with VCs that have so much money allocated to crypto investments that when you would bring up something like, hey, why don't you look at more traditional crypto investments or bigger names, whether it be Bitcoin, Ethereum, you know, something, that's not why they're raising so much money. That's not why they're raising $20 billion and charging 2 and 20. So they're going to continue to recycle that money through every new crypto, either, you know, startup or token or whatever, because the money's just going to continue to flow.
Or they're raising money because they say they're a crypto VC fund and a sovereign wealth nations that can't buy Bitcoin but want exposure to crypto invest in these VC funds. So they just come up with a message that raises the money. And I'm not saying crypto's a scam. I'm saying maybe 95% of it is a scam. There's some percent that's legit. But look, hedge funds we know are a scam, not because we ran one, but because you could look right now, hedge funds charge enormous fees. Like, let's say a hedge fund has $1 billion. They could make up to $60 million a year if they return 20% and get their 2% fees. The same mutual fund with $1 billion would probably make, instead of $60 million, would make $5 million. And what's the difference? We look up the holdings. They all own Google, Facebook, Netflix, Exxon, Microsoft. They own the same stocks.
I would just to add a little bit of nuance to this. I think we should differentiate between scams and things that are disingenuous. So a scam to me is like an outright fraud.
Yeah.
Where someone's literally lying to you and probably doing something that is illegal. And even if not by the letter of the law, then certainly within the spirit of the law. And there's no shortages of those out there. I think what's been interesting in recent years, even in crypto, is that like you see a lot more of what I would consider disingenuous, or maybe that's not the right word, but the people who are backing the project or running the project or the company present a front of confidence that deep down inside, they don't actually believe. So it doesn't mean they're stealing your money, but I think, like, I don't see how anybody could be an executive at a company like Uber 10 years after it's failed to turn a profit, burning billions and billions of dollars. And I don't see how, like, in their private conversations, if you were good friends with them and you were like, hey, so-and-so, like, is Uber ever really going to make money? They have to have some doubt at this point. But then that's not what they can say on the earnings call, because right, the stock would just completely collapse.
You are correct in making that distinction. But at the same time, I would say it's pretty gray. I mean, if they know, you know, ultimately that it's not really viable long term. I agree, they're gonna provide a united front. They're gonna have what they deem as a reasonable business model. But deep down, they know investing $100 million at a $10 billion valuation is something that has no viable way of ever reaching that.
And this is where it is a gray area. Is it a scam or is it disingenuous? Like, the VCs who invested at a $10 billion valuation, they invested not because this is a great company, but because they knew they would be able to take it public, again, to sell it to the stupid money at a $50 billion valuation.
To be fair, the VCs, that business model, at least for now, and has been, is very much intact. They know what they're doing. They know they're going to be able to push these to valuation. They know there's going to be money out there, and there's going to be a way to sell this at a higher price to someone else. And even if they don't, they don't need to bat 800. They need to bat 200. You know, I mean, we know that model, right? A ton of these will fail, but they know the Ubers and the big ones will take care of it. So that works. But this is, you know, we've talked about this a long time ago also about even the PE firms. We've always looked at those and said, wait a second, like they have no real edge. Who was the Yale endowment guy that called him out?
David Swensen.
Yeah.
So the most successful college money manager out there, he wrote a book about investing. And he basically said investing in private equity was like, you know, buying the S&P 500, but with leverage, like, you know, buying three or four times the S&P 500 by borrowing money. And with private equity firms, you'll never know how they do because it's private. But when the market does well, they'll have enormous gains because that's when they sell all their BS companies. Yeah. And when the market doesn't do well, you don't hear from them. Right. So you don't know how they're doing. But Dan, tell your experience. You don't have to say the name of the firm, but like when you were working for a huge private equity firm, several hundred million dollars was huge back then in the 90s. Tell your experience of like how they raise money. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
When I left, you know, the investment bank where I was working and went to work for a large private equity firm, as I was coming in, they were raising a new fund, which at the time was an enormous, you know, number, late 90s. And I remember opening up the pitch book and seeing the memorandum. The number one, the top, right at the top, their best performing portfolio company. They had the IRR right next to it. It was just off the wall, right? It was a huge IRR, huge home run. Led the way to them raising the fund. We raised the fund. We closed the new fund. I want to say the new fund was, you know, close to $1 billion, maybe a couple billion. And within months of us closing the new fund, the best investment we made went bankrupt. Literally went bankrupt. And I remember the partners scrambling, what are we going to do? Like we literally sold everyone on our ability and on our return, and the company went bankrupt. So, you know, again, was it, you know, disingenuous? I mean, was there a gray area? I mean, and that's, but soon after, no one cared. You know, they just started making new investments and wrote that one down to zero. And, you know, that's when I kind of looked at it and I'm like, this, you know, It's the classic situation. They raise money, like you said. They exit when everyone else exits, and then they just go quiet.
And here's where it's also a gray area. You know, you would think, like with Madoff, for instance, as an extreme example, you would think the people who invested in the Madoff fund were innocent victims. But the reality is, you ask somebody who invested in a Madoff fund, why did you invest in the Madoff fund? They all thought he was doing something illegal.
Yeah.
They thought, but it was different than, they didn't think he was a Ponzi scheme. They thought he had some edge. Front running his customers from the brokerage side of his firm. And so like he knew what they were investing in and he would buy first. So they were willing to participate in a scam that they knew was illegal. So were they complicit in some way? Of course they were. And so I'm just curious, like, what business, forget about like finance even, like what business just by itself is not a scam of some sort?
I think, so the one thing with finance is there is this element of musical chairs that everybody is either implicitly or explicitly buying into, right? Like VC works.
Maybe because the economy grows. Like there are inventions and innovations and, you know, every now and then there's a company that truly is great.
Yeah. What we've been saying about PE and VC, like it's true enough that a lot of what they do works so long as there is a greater fool who's willing to pay a higher price for whatever they're investing in. And we've had multi-year, decade-plus cycles where that generally works. And when we all work together, we used to talk about this, how we would make decisions sometimes where we felt like the long-term interest of our LPs would be represented by either doing or not doing something. However, there was an immediate short-term gain to be had, which our competitors were taking advantage of. And then they would turn around and be like, oh, you know, we've made X percent a month. And we would sit there and be like, well, that's not sustainable. That's going to end badly, et cetera, et cetera. But then when the music stopped, it ended badly for everybody. And I think...
We couldn't invest in John Paulson's fund, you know, right. Which is he was the biggest winner shorting the housing situation. He made a lot of money in the financial crisis. We couldn't invest with him because he was losing money every month until Lehman Brothers blew up. And then he made an enormous amount of money, but we couldn't afford to lose a little bit of money every month.
Right.
Yeah. So going back to the question of what actually creates value, I think like one of the interesting things about the pandemic was it focused all of our attention on the things in the economy that actually really matter that we take for granted, like restaurants and supermarkets and truck drivers and laundromats and on and on. So there is this fascinating interplay between those kinds of businesses. Like restaurants obviously create value, right? Like personally, I love going to restaurants. And by and large, I feel like you get what you pay for. But then there's this fascinating interaction between the financial world and these quote unquote real world businesses. And I still actually do not have a good mental model of what within finance you consider honest value contributing activity.
Well, let me take it into a different area. Sports. Let's take basketball as an example. I'm not saying a basketball team/company is a scam, but there's so much potentially bad behavior happening, like, you know, drafting kids or paying kids in high school or you know, Dan, what do they do in basketball? And I'm just making, I could pick any sport.
It's all the sports, but that's another, you know, I question it every day. I questioned it earlier today. I saw, you know, this is just random, but these teams, and you've seen that the salaries of basketball, football, baseball, they just simply never stop. They go up every year at astronomical rates. And so you just have to ask yourself at some point, when does that, is that simply not a greater fool theory, but you know, ESPN, ABC, you know, all these networks, Amazon's now getting into it. Apple's getting into this game where they're just overpaying for TV and broadcast rights. And so I guess the money's there, but at some point that has to collapse also. And I know everyone says, you know, they said that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you know, just franchise value, everything just continues to go up. And I just think who's, you know, but it's usually VC guys buying sports teams and paying these astronomical, you know? And so you wonder if that's when it ends, when that piece collapses. But you know, you're talking not even star players, just role players are making hundreds of millions of dollars, you know? And so, and I just wonder because the kids don't watch it anymore. None of my kids, no kid has an attention span to watch a sporting event. I mean, they watch clips.
You know, that's a good point, actually. Like when we were younger, there was basically, you had no choices for entertainment. You either watch a sports game or you watch Laverne and Shirley or something like that. And Now there are so many choices. Like people spend hours on TikTok and Facebook and Instagram, on YouTube, and then there's all the streaming services. Who does watch a basketball game? Like, are there people, is there ratings, TV ratings for these basketball games,
sure,
or baseball games or whatever?
Playoffs and, you know, regionally, maybe.
There is one thing that some live sports has going for it, which is that with the media market becoming increasingly fragmented between Netflix, YouTube, TikTok, etc., events like, say, the Super Bowl or the NBA playoffs are sort of like the last place for advertisers who want to reach, yes, a mass market at once. So that, I think there is value in that.
Because you have to watch it in real time too.
Which is special, right? Yes. Like there's a part of me that actually likes that about sports, that I'm watching it at the same exact time that all my friends and family are watching it. And it's not like, I don't know, some hot TV show where it's like, oh, I haven't watched it yet, I'm going to binge watch it when it's over. But the other thing about pro sports that I've always thought fascinating from an economic point of view is there are many things that pro sports gets away with that would be completely illegal in any other industry.
Like what?
Well, first of all, like most pro sports teams are government subsidized monopolies.
Yes.
So not only do you have a local monopoly, right? Like, the three of us couldn't just be like, we want to start our own basketball team and have it be in New York and be part of the National Basketball Association. The NBA legally can stop that in ways that no other industry could. The whole labor market is completely manipulated and fixed, right? Just think about the idea of a draft. Can you imagine if like any other industry colluded to say that, oh, there are college students graduating and we're going to take every programmer, and then we're going to have a draft for software engineers, and we're going to like pick them in order, and they're not allowed to independently negotiate with anybody until we tell them which company they're going to work for. And a lot of their salaries are fixed because we determine that the starting salary for an engineer is X. Baseball actually has a specific antitrust exemption in the US, which is also crazy. But all the other sports, like every time I go to a baseball game here in New York, and I'm like, city runs extra trains to get people there. They provide all these extra cops and stuff to provide security. A lot of times they're not paying taxes, or like the government spend $1 billion to help build their stadium. Almost no other industry enjoys those kinds of government protections.
Yeah.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
All right, let's take another industry, the music industry. So do you mean to tell me that it's a coincidence that the top 50 or 100 musicians on the planet, as ranked by Billboard every week, happen to be also amazingly good looking? Like, it just happens to be the case that these people who are like so amazing looking spent 3/4 of their lives practicing the guitar and never thinking about their looks. It just was an afterthought for them. And they all became like, nobody ugly practiced guitar their whole lives. And then, by the way, then there's one company in, I think it's Sweden. There was a book about it called The Hit Factory that produces all the top 10 songs. Like, they have a formula.
They know exactly what gets hits.
Yeah.
And then if your voice is bad, they auto-tune it so you sound perfect.
It's Milli Vanilli.
Exactly. Except that guy, one half of Milli Vanilli, was so ashamed.
He killed himself.
Yes. And now it's just an everyday thing. Every single band on the planet. Like, for all I know, Paul McCartney lip syncs when he performs.
That's what's crazy about that industry is Milli Vanilli, I can't remember, Rob Pilatus, maybe one of the halves of Milli and the other, killed himself. And fast forward, not a lot, you know, beyond that. And no one even cares about lip syncing. They all do it. It's not even shameful.
100% now.
But that just means that that's what the market wants.
Right.
I don't have a problem with anything that you said, is because they're selling entertainment. And like, there are probably a lot of unattractive, very talented musicians playing local bars and clubs, or they have a niche following of 10,000 fans or something.
I agree. Like, it's overstating it to say they're a scam. Maybe another way of stating it is not everything is what they seem. Like, when Billboard lists the top 100 musicians, these aren't necessarily the best musicians. When a bookstore or a New York Times bestseller list, we already know the New York Times bestseller list for books doesn't actually rank the top selling books. It's just someone's opinion about what the best books are. Like, that was revealed in the past 5 or 10 years or whatever. I'm just trying to think of like what industry, we know with finance, it's all, you know, borderline illegal. What industry is actually like legit? Like even law firms, do they, you know, I remember one time, well, this was pre-OMID, Dan and I were starting a hedge fund and I took the old docs for our older hedge fund and just did a search and replace. It wasn't that hard to figure out. It was a 30-page document where I just switched one name to another. And my lawyer found out about it, that I had done that. He called me up and he was yelling at me. This grown man was yelling at me, another grown man. He said, I never have seen anything like this in the industry. How could you do this? And I said, well, I bought the original documents from you for $30,000, a 20-page document. Why can't I do what I want with it? I own it.
Yeah.
And he had no response to that, because that was like an implicit scam that they were running.
Yeah.
How about pay-to-play podcasting, James, which you are not, but since the new book came out, I hear from all these podcasts that are like, oh, we'd love for you to come on our show, blah, blah, blah. If you just pay us $1,000, we can book you for next week.
I didn't even know that existed, but that's totally... Do they have to disclose that they were paid?
I don't think they do. I mean, someone actually literally, some promoter sent me like a menu of like, here are these podcasts and here's like how many downloads they get. And then here's what they charge to be on the show.
After this episode, James would like to talk to you offline about that.
Yeah, I charge $75,000.
Right, but only in Monero.
That's right.
I've had people offer to pay me to be on the podcast, but I've always, there's no need for it. Like, I make money from ads, and it's enough to pay for Jay, the audio engineer, who gets paid in Malaysian, you know, shekels or whatever. So
it's a throwback to the DJ business, right? Payola, isn't that what they called it?
Yeah.
Like, that's what
which was illegal.
Was it really? That's interesting. So I wonder.
Oh, no. For DJs, it wasn't illegal. Sorry. But for radio shows, it was. For radio music shows, it was illegal.
Oh. But isn't that why you've seen like a resurgence or, and we talk about this all the time when it relates to, I mean, another huge scam, obviously, James, we've talked about this forever, colleges, right? And you're seeing more and more people kind of talk about that. But that's why you're seeing like a resurgence of people saying, look, there should be trade schools, or you should go into HVAC, plumbing, electrician, because it's a real skill where you're providing something real that people need and they'll pay you for it in exchange, as opposed to traditional stuff, lawyer, finance, like we're talking that when you run into a pandemic or something and it's not real, or they can't push that same product, you basically are out of a job. You know, when you see, whereas if there's a truly a recession, people still need, you know, if they have a plumbing issue, if their air conditioner goes out, if their roof's leaking, you know, that's real. That's where there is value in exchange for something that, you know, and those are traditional, but we've kind of gone away from that, right? I mean, you never encourage your kids to become a plumber or an electrician, but you're seeing more and more people just because all these other industries have popped up and they just don't seem sustainable over time.
Well, I challenge anyone listening to this even to what industry is not, like, other than those, I agree with you, Dan. So plumber, electrician are largely not a scam. Sometimes there's issues where they say, oh, there's extensive, you know, we have to redo all the pipes. And then you have to kind of like get a second opinion and hope for the best. Sure. But I sort of feel like most industries, like let's take psychologists, you know, or psychiatry. It's all this everybody's got medication now. And I'm not passing judgment on that, but it's just, why is it the case that kids seemed healthy 100 years ago and now 90% of kids are on medication? Or, you know, everybody's got some diagnosis in the, you know, diagnostic and statistical manual of disorders. I can't think of any industry really. Maybe, what about teaching? Well, no, that's all related to the education thing. What about like a piano instructor?
That's like any skill, whether it be piano, sports, anything. And that's a huge industry now, right? With kids, right? Parents all want their kids to be an excellent, you know, pianist or baseball player or basketball player. And parents nowadays are willing to overpay instructors to make their kids special, right? No, our parents never did that. My parents didn't do that. You just went outside and played and found the best kid in the neighborhood and challenged yourself. Now parents overpay, and this entire industry has popped up. Youth sports, youth, you know, instruments, youth, you know, chess clubs, right? And if some parent whose mom or dad is a VC, James, comes to you and says, hey, I'd love, you know, little Johnny or Mary to learn chess from you, you're not going to teach Johnny or Mary how to play chess in a week. You're going to stretch that out over 3-4 years. And the VC mom or dad's going to pay you well for 4 years, right? I mean, you're not really going to be honest there. You're going to say, this takes a long time. This takes a long time. And you're going to have 20 of those kids. And there's entire industries that have popped up over this. So I don't know if that means it's a scam, right? Someone's just has a skill and they're, you know, I guess someone can always come in and undercut you there, but that's, you know, that's an anything.
Well, you guys, thanks once again for coming on the podcast, as always.
Thank you.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.